Deutsche Welle. Spectrum.
Hello and welcome to Spectrum, your weekly dose of science and technology from DW in Bonn, Germany. I'm Nicole Grubel, your host this week. Coming up on this week's show, how the bugs on your car's number plate can help scientists and the environment.
I'm absolutely fond of citizen science projects, and without these people, we were not able to have this such a good overview at such a large scale, because I can't pay researchers to go throughout the Netherlands and measure the number of insects on their license plate. It would be far too costly.
And geologists say Africa has more water reserves than previously thought.
If you drill a borehole, you might not get very large yields of water, but crucially, you often get enough for a borehole and a hand pump.
We'll hear more about those issues in a short while, but let's start in Turkey. Every year since 1993, May 3rd has marked World Press Freedom Day. The day is designed to emphasise the need for independent media across the world, and it's a chance to spread the word about violations of press freedom. With over 100 journalists in jail, Turkey has an unenviable record on press freedom. But at the same time, the country has taken to social media like fish to water. Just under half the country is on Facebook, for example, ranking it fourth in the world. Twitter is also hugely popular there. While few speak of outright censorship, many feel that mainstream media often don't tell the full story, as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
In a cafe in downtown Istanbul, Hale is getting up to date with the news. For her, it's tweets and the wider social media, who she now relies on for finding out what's going on.
Open the Twitter and, you know, check the mails. And, you know, I'm trying not to use the phone to check the tweets mostly. I only check to see if there are some hot issues or something urgent to see. Mostly there is in the case of Turkey. Now I'm, in fact, checking the newspaper sites less, because I get most of the information from Twitter. So you have blogs, you have news sites. So I don't care about what the mainstream media does.
It was last year's first successive landslide election victory by the ruling AK party. That was a green light for it turning up the pressure on the mainstream media, according to Professor Yaman Akdeniz, an expert on communications at Istanbul's Bilgi University. He says with arrests of journalists continuing, along with pressure on media owners, Turkish media is increasingly cowed, opening the door to alternative providers.
Since the elections, the current government came up with strong votes, and as a result of which we can feel that the media is not directly but indirectly controlled by the government, and we witness self-censorship or self-policing by television channels and also by newspapers. So this resulted with the society reacting to these examples and so turning into other forms of news gathering and obtaining news. And also people started to act as journalists themselves.
Turkey has been among the front runners in developing mobile telephony and internet penetration. Coupled with a young and net-savvy population, the result has been an explosion in social media. 30 million Facebook users and 4 million tweeters. That has created an opening for the rapid growth of people turning to social media for news. Last December, its power was felt. On the night of December the 29th, 35 Turkish Kurdish smugglers, most of whom were only teenagers, were killed in a botched Turkish airstrike aimed at the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK. Such mistakes are usually covered up in a veil of secrecy with strict anti-terror laws. But not this time. Çiğdem Mehta is a social political activist with 16,000 tweet followers. For Mehta, the event was a coming of age for tweets as a news source.
When I woke up, I just checked the Twitter and I saw that some people are speaking about something in Uludere. At 7:30, I saw the first pictures. Because some people in Uludere took the pictures of the dead bodies shot by the Turkish planes. And even the families have started to speak about what happened, and we know about it. And until 5 o'clock afternoon, there was nothing on the Turkish media. It was one of the biggest example of the independent media and this citizen journalism can work. But it was so weird because all the journalists that who are active in Twitter, but who are at the same time active in the mainstream media, were just saying during the day that, oh my God, there is such a thing and none of the mainstream media is speaking about it. But I'm just thinking, if Twitter doesn't exist in Uludere incident, for example, I'm sure that we're going to hear about it like maybe 2-3 days later, and we will never going to know this much about it.
The lightning speed spread of info from the rugged, mountainous region was made possible by widespread fast 3G coverage. Ironically, that is a legacy of the army's decades-long campaign against the Kurdish rebels in the predominantly Kurdish southeast. For even though it's one of the poorest and rural regions, it has well-developed communications, due to the security forces relying heavily on mobile phones. Coupled with ferocious competition by phone operators offering cheap smartphones, resulting in nearly a quarter of the country's phone users owning one, means even in the impoverished Kurdish southeast, such technology is widely available. Berke Bash is a teacher of media studies and is currently working on a project on Kurdish youth.
Major phone companies provide free cell phones and Facebook and Twitter service to the cell phone users. And many of the kids starting around 12 years old to 22, 23 have cell phones and are connected to Facebook, and think it's very important that it's main source of news for them, because Turkish media has no interest and real inquiry into what are the dynamics in the southeast and what are the demands of these people and what are these people are reacting against. And it builds up an incredible anger. But I think we still have to have faith in mainstream media, because social media creates their its own small communities where you don't interact. So I think what is definitely needed in this country, that Turks and Kurds get to know each other.
That fear is echoed by Professor Akdeniz. He says the country is already deeply divided along ethnic and political lines. But he fears the government may take the wrong steps to address the situation.
Polarization is going to be a huge problem, in my view, and it will be difficult to address. But I can only say that censorship is not the solution, or filtering or blocking these sites. But I think the next level will be more prosecutions and more prosecutions. They will start going after people. Then perhaps people might start getting worried about using these microblogging sites or social media platforms.
Turkey's anti-terror laws, characterized by catch-all phrases, has been used against numerous journalists and academics, but it remains unclear whether it covers tweets. But for tweet activist Meta, she's concerned.
I feel like there is something like a big brother watching all of us. It's a very Turkish position in the last 2 years now. Everyone is feeling that everyone are under the record of the state. But now, for example, sometimes I feel like, should I write this or not?
Turkey already is one of the world's worst offenders for blocking internet sites. It even blocked for 2 years YouTube and has threatened Facebook. But Twitter and similar sites have proved notoriously difficult to block, while the country's net-savvy population are proving adept at circumventing bans and blocks, and it remains easy to protect Twitter identities. For better or worse in Turkey, the Twitter news genie appears well and truly out of the bottle. Dorian Jones, DW, Istanbul.
Africa's home to many an impressive beast, but it's the Anopheles mosquito that is arguably its most dangerous animal. It's the one that spreads malaria. The tiny parasite still kills about 1 million people each year in tropical regions around the world. Just a few days ago, the World Health Organization highlighted the issues around the illness again, with its annual World Malaria Day. Sonia Dean presents Fabian Schmidt's report on how doctors are battling malaria.
Malaria begins with fevers and chills, and it often ends up being deadly. When it doesn't kill, it can damage organs such as the spleen and kidneys. Kai Breaker, a doctor and head of the aid organization Doctors Without Borders, says half of those dying are children. The situation is worst in regions along the equator.
As a doctor in these countries, there are still a lot of patients with malaria. They're often children who are so anemic they can barely breathe anymore. It's really horrifying.
Horrifying as well, because tests can quickly identify the illness. Rapid administration of artemisinin-based anti-malarial medications provide effective treatment.
The problem, which is also present where Doctors Without Borders works, is that the medications just aren't available. Large portions of the population still have very poor access to malaria treatment.
That's why malaria is considered an illness of the poor, Breaker says.
It's a vicious cycle. On the one side, someone who lives in poverty has a far higher risk of contracting malaria. That's often connected to a lack of education. And when someone isn't educated, they won't recognize the early symptoms or know where to seek treatment. On the other side, malaria impacts on the productivity of a population, making it even poorer.
But that doesn't have to be the case. Malaria can also be treated through a number of measures. Aside from diagnosis and treatment, the carrier of the parasite, the Anopheles mosquito, must be targeted. Jürgen May, a doctor with the Bernhard Nocht Institute for Tropical Medicine in Hamburg, cites a tried-and-true means.
Those who aren't bitten don't contract malaria. To that end, bed nets or other measures can prevent exposure.
Bed nets are particularly effective because the Anopheles mosquito is primarily active at night.
They start biting at dusk. They peak around midnight, then gradually decrease their activity until dawn.
Mosquito nets must, of course, be free of holes. Ideally, they should also be infused with insecticide, which kills the mosquitoes upon contact. And, although it's been taboo as environmentally destructive since the 1960s, the insecticide DDT has proved reliable.
I was just in Ghana visiting a hospital in a region where they've been using DDT for several years. To my surprise, the children's ward was practically empty. 5 years earlier, the hospital was so full that children had to lie on mattresses on the floor.
DDT was once sprayed over wide agricultural expanses. Working its way up the food chain, DDT poisoned animals, including humans. Although it's been banned in many places, the World Health Organization is now recommending use on walls and mosquito nets within the home. Mai says that when properly used, DDT is not dangerous to people, but very effective against mosquitoes.
When we take blood samples in these regions, we see that most school children have the parasite in their blood without showing signs of illness. It acts as a form of immunization, but the semi-immunity wears off, and 2 or 3 years later, a person is just as susceptible as a small child.
Before such systematic use of DDT in homes, the hospital treated around 6,000 malaria patients per month. Nowadays, that number is 40 at most. Draining wetlands, a decisive factor in ridding Europe of malaria in the 19th century, won't work in tropical regions. Large marshlands remain unsettled, while water collects regardless in areas close to people during rainy seasons, Mai says. So, people have to live with malaria. And they do. Adults in malarial regions appear to have developed partial immunity against the parasite. In other words, a few bites may actually help. This is also the reason why Africans who stay for longer periods of time in Europe often become sick after traveling back home. And it's grounds for doctors to continue to hold out hope for a vaccination.
There are about 25 serious contenders for a malaria vaccination, but only one of these is actually being tested on people. Currently, it's being used on a group of about 16,000 people in an area of Africa, and it's really showing promise.
Mai Preliminary results show that the vaccination can reduce infections of malaria by 60%. This is still less than inoculations against yellow fever or tetanus, which have effectiveness rates of almost 100%, demonstrating that malaria efforts still have a long way to go. Sonia Dean, DW.
There are no Anopheles mosquitoes in the Netherlands, but the country boasts plenty of other insects. As anyone who drives knows, they can often end up on your windshield or number plate. Well, next time you clean your car, think again. Biologists from Wageningen University could use some of the 133 billion bugs that end up on Dutch vehicles. Through a so-called citizen science project, people are asked to count the number of dead bugs on their number plates after a drive and fill in that information on a special website called splashteller.nl. Through this project, biologists are hoping to find out more about biodiversity in the Netherlands. Laura Postma gave it a go.
It seems a bit odd that dead bugs on a license plate can provide valuable information for scientists. But biologist Arnold van Vliet from Wageningen University says he could not do his research on insects and their influence on biodiversity in the Netherlands without the help of his fellow citizens. So to help science along, we are going to participate in the project by taking a little drive. First, we need to make sure that the license plate is clean and free of previously killed bugs. Then we're ready to go. We drive for about 60 kilometers from the southern province Noord-Brabant to Utrecht in the central part of the Netherlands. The number of dead bugs after this drive? 5. What does this information tell biologist Van Vliet?
That's already quite a lot. When we did this for the first time in 2011, in June, over 600 people participated then. And we found an average of 2 dead insects per 10 kilometers. So you had about 8 per 10 kilometers, so you were above average. And that doesn't sound very much, but if you start calculating, then you come up with numbers like, with 2 bugs per 10 kilometers, with numbers of 133 billion insects killed by cars in June alone in the Netherlands. And that's an enormous amount of insects, of course.
Since the start of the project, almost 1 year ago, approximately 600 people counted dead insects on their license plate and shared that information with Van Vliet via the website splashteller.nl.
I'm absolutely fond of citizen science projects. And without these people, we were not able to have this such a good overview at such a large scale, because I can't pay researchers to go throughout the Netherlands and measure the number of insects on their license plate. It would be far too costly. And with this, people enjoy it and, yeah, you get nice results.
With 7 million cars in the Netherlands that drive over 200 billion kilometers per year, Van Vliet saw an ideal opportunity for his type of research.
You should imagine that these license plates are standard format, so they are nicely standardized. And people drive continuously and they catch bugs on their license plate. And it gives a good indication for the number of bugs and the density of bugs in a certain area. And that provides a lot of interesting ecological information. Bugs play an important role in, for example, the food supply for birds. Now, for the first time, we get information about the density of bugs. So that's interesting also in explaining variation in breeding success, for example, of birds, of population of birds. Why are there many birds in some parts of the Netherlands and why are there less in some other parts? And can insects and insect density explain that?
Van Vliet says the Netherlands is on the bottom of the list in Europe when it comes to biodiversity. He explains that the information he gets from dead insects on license plates can also provide more information about this.
We see a very significant decrease in the number of species. A large percentage is threatened. Up to 2/3 of the species, depending on the species groups, is threatened. And that is another good thing. And that's another thing, that insect density might also give an indication or an explanation of the changes in biodiversity, or at least biomass of insects or bugs. And we hope that this information can provide additional insights in changes in biodiversity.
Van Vliet explains why specifically the Netherlands is not doing well compared to other European countries.
There are so many people living in the Netherlands on a very small area. Many cars, many roads, many houses, large agricultural activities, causing a lot of pressure on these animals and plants. So that is a combination of reasons.
Van Vliet says he needs at least one or two more years to get all of the answers to the questions about insects and biodiversity that he's looking for. After that, he can draw some serious conclusions. The only problem is that he cannot yet compare his information with other countries. Wageningen University is the only university at the moment doing this kind of research that involves citizens in their scientific research.
Yeah, I've seen some more private initiatives in the United States where people tried it, but they had more difficulties in really get it accepted, this type of research. And I don't know of any other initiatives so far. So hopefully we can broaden it in the future. So this is, in that sense, it's quite unique.
It is Van Vliet's goal to share his experiences with the scientific community. But, he says, all of the results will also be shared on the website splashteller.nl. That way he can inform everybody who participated in the project about the things that Van Vliet has been observing and what he expects for the future about the insect density in the Netherlands. This was Laura Postma for DW in Wageningen.
Time for some news and brief now with Nigel Tandy.
The Federal Trade Commission in the US has hired a prominent trial lawyer to oversee an ongoing investigation into Google's business practices. Former Justice Department prosecutor Beth Wilkinson will head a team looking into allegations that Google has been abusing its dominance in the field of internet search to stifle competition and drive up advertising prices. Wilkinson is best known for helping to convict Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh in 1997. The announcement comes just a few days after Google launched Drive, which allows users to store personal documents, photos, videos, and other digital content on Google's computers. Children who have suffered violence may age more quickly than those who have not been abused. A new study from the University of Durham in the north of England found that violence may do lasting damage to a person's DNA and speed up cellular aging by 7 to 10 years. The scientists measured the length of so-called telomeres. Those are the ends that hold together the chromosomes and keep them from fraying, a bit like the end of a shoelace. They found that the telomeres shorten faster than normal, a sign of aging cells. Levels of consumption between developing and developed nations must be rebalanced to fight absolute poverty, which affects around 1.3 billion people globally. That's according to a new report entitled People and the Planet by the Royal Society, Britain's 350-year-old National Academy of Science. The international team of 23 authors calls on governments to consider population growth and the effects excessive consumption in developed nations have on the world's poorest.
That was Nigel Tandy with a roundup of the latest SciTech news. Across the globe, one in six people don't have access to clean drinking water. That's 1.1 billion people, according to statistics from the World Water Council. Many of those are in Africa, but the continent actually sits on vast reservoirs of groundwater. Scientists from the UK have now, for the first time, put together a map of exactly where these reservoirs, also known as aquifers, are. Although not all of them can be accessed, they could still play a vital role in supplying millions of people with clean water. I spoke to Alan MacDonald, principal hydrogeologist at the British Geological Survey, who also led the project. I began by asking him where the biggest reserves are in Africa.
The largest groundwater reserves in Africa are actually in North Africa, under the Sahara Desert. And that's been known about for quite a number of years. But they're far from where most people live. So the water resources, the groundwater resources that I'm most interested in are those that are away from there, the smaller groundwater reserves that are under the rest of Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, where most of the population are those without access to clean water.
So what countries specifically would we find these reserves in?
The largest groundwater reserves are in North Africa, so under Libya and Algeria, Sudan and Egypt. These large sandstone aquifers are several hundred metres thick. And some of them are exploited for groundwater at the moment, for example, in Libya. But the issue with these groundwater resources, these large ones, is that they were actually filled up with rainwater about 5,000 years ago. So they're not currently being recharged at all. So the water in these large aquifers in North Africa is what we call fossil water. It was laid down about 5,000 years ago when the climate there was much wetter.
We've known about groundwater reservoirs for some time. What's new about this map and how did you produce it?
The groundwater in Africa and across the world has been known and studied for many decades. And the work that we've done is just pulling together work that's already previously been undertaken across Africa. So in a way, our map isn't startling or new. What it is a first time of actually quantifying the amount of groundwater there. So what we've done is over the last 2 years, funded by the UK Department for International Development, is pull together all the existing maps for Africa for different countries and different areas, and also about 300 aquifer studies from different parts of Africa. And we've pulled them all together and analysed them and then produced this one map which actually tries to document for the first time how much groundwater is in different areas and also how easy it would be to extract that water, to drill a borehole and to get a water supply from the groundwater.
Now, access to some of these aquifers is limited. How can these reserves be tapped in a sustainable way?
Well, that's a very good question. And the areas that I'm most interested in are in sub-Saharan Africa, where there aren't huge groundwater reserves, so away from North Africa. And what you find is that if you drill a borehole, you might not get very large yields of water. But crucially, you often get enough for a borehole and a hand pump. So these groundwater reserves across much of Africa are sufficient for a community borehole drilled to maybe 50 or 100 metres deep, equipped with a hand pump. So the groundwater reserves might be enough for that, which is good news for those who don't have access to water at the moment, the 300 million people across Africa that don't have access to water. So with careful investigation and proper siting and construction of these boreholes, they should be able to find groundwater. But for larger yields of water, it's much more problematic to access the groundwater. So, for example, if people are wanting to do large-scale commercial irrigation, which requires a lot of water, they wouldn't be able to drill everywhere in Africa and find they could exploit groundwater for that. There'd only be certain areas that they would be able to drill and find that water. And as you pointed out in your question, there would be issues there about sustainability. If you're pulling out huge amounts of groundwater and it's not actively being recharged, then that water will run out.
So what are your practical suggestions for governments or NGOs or any kind of aid organisation that might work in these areas or in these countries? What should they do?
I think firstly, it's acknowledging that this groundwater is there and realising that for much of Africa, water resources are available for community boreholes and hand pumps. And with careful investigation and the proper expertise, these groundwater resources could be exploited for more drought-proof and climate-resilient water supplies for communities. So in a way, that's one of our messages. The other message would be to be careful about investing in large irrigation or even city supplies that rely on having high-yielding boreholes and wells, to be careful about that and make sure that there is sufficient investigations carried out before they do that to find out where the groundwater is and if it's going to be sustainable.
That was Alan MacDonald from the British Geological Survey. That's it from Spectrum this week. Don't forget you can listen to all the reports again online at dw.de. You can also find more science and technology news and features there. From me and the rest of the Spectrum team, Nigel Tandy and Thomas Schmidt, it's goodbye for now. I won't let you down.